Mr. Greenhouse, Reel 2. It seems strange that you should be have been a snob if you're a communist.
Well, maybe the snob is the wrong word. Maybe it was ambition. I've been to grammar school, you see, and I was the odd man out in the grammar school. I was a poor child. I suffered all the indignities of being poor when I went to the grammar school and so on, you see. So I really wanted to learn as much as I could and to learn the things which were normally forbidden to the working class families.
So you didn't read the Marxist classics at that time?
Not at that time, no. Not before I went to Spain.
Why not?
I never had the real opportunity. I mean, don't forget, I was earning a living and I was working as hard as I could and so on.
What job were you doing?
I was, by then I was a painter and decorator because I'd had some very varied career. When I left school, I had a matriculation certificate and the first job that I went after was the at the town hall. There were some vacancies in the town hall treasurer's department and there was an open entrance examination. I think about 200 of us sat the exam. And I later learned that one of the vacancies had been filled by a boy from my school who didn't sit the exam, but whose uncle worked in the town hall. Eventually, I became a trainee accountant or trainee clerk in a cotton warehouse in Piccadilly, Manchester. This was Richardson T. Mycroft, and they sold cotton goods as wholesalers. And my job was to check all the invoices and make sure that they were okay across, checking all the items and so on, checking all the everything else and making sure that the invoices were correct. And also doing whatever other work was necessary in the department, such as emptying goods into the shelves, ready to go out and so on. The salary was £12 a year, and that wasn't even enough. I mean, I had to walk to work because I couldn't afford the tram fare into town. And at the end, I was told that at the end of the year I would be given the proper salary once I'd learned how to do the job. So at the end of the year, I applied for an increase in salary, a proper salary, and was introduced into the office of the chairman of the board. And I shall never forget this white-faced man, pudgy-faced man with a Churchill collar, big thick hands, sitting behind his desk. And he told me that they couldn't afford to give me any more money, but I had a wonderful opportunity, and if I stuck at it, I'd done very well in the year, and if I stuck at it, then possibly at the end of the next year, they could see their way to giving me some extra money. I just walked out, and I never went back. And then I became an apprentice in a chemist shop. It was a branch of the main shop, and it was a small side street chemist. The old man in there was a very, very good chemist, very good dispenser. And he was teaching me dispensing. But after about 2 months, I was told that I had to leave that branch and go into the main shop because they'd got another man. I learnt later on that his parents were paying for his tuition, and therefore it was cheaper than I was getting, something about 7 shillings a week then. And when I went to the other shop, it was a big branch with 3 assistants. And none of these assistants was qualified. But the boss was qualified MPS. And We used to make up these NHS medicines in big jars like this.
NHS?
It was the not NHS in those days, but it was the parish health service. And so we got these prescriptions, you see, and there was usually about six major prescriptions, you know, the tonic, one which was for tummy trouble, and the other one which was for colds and so on. And we made all these things up in the big one, and then you poured 1/12 in the bottle, you filled it up with water, and you put the label on, and that was that, you see. And of course, also the selling all the various patent medicines around the shop, and there's toiletries and so on. And I was then attending as a one day a week the technical college in Stockport, learning biology and chemistry and so on, you see. The idea being that I would eventually get an MPS, but then my eyes were opened by one of the other assistants who said to me, has your family got plenty of money? So I said, no, I've got none whatsoever. He said, well, you'll never become an MPS, he said, because it means 2 years in Edinburgh, and you don't get a grant for that 2 years in Edinburgh before you can become your MPS. I'd already sent off my matriculation certificate to the MPS people and accepted that this would give me entry onto the course, you see. But there was no point to it, you know. It wasn't going to get me anywhere. So I left there and went to another chemist shop for a little bit more money. But in order to get my day off work, I had to work Sundays cleaning the shop. And I decided that, you know, it just wasn't, I mean, it was a dream and I had to give that dream up. In the meantime, my mother had taken in a lodger who was a building worker, painter and decorator. And he sort of suggested that I go and work with him for a while. So I didn't like that. But then I got a job in Woolworths. In the warehouse in Woolworths, where I was stock keeper, I found out that this was real slave work. By then, I was becoming politically interested as well. You see, in those days, the girls in Woolworths would have to start work at 8:30 in the morning. Especially on Saturday, 8:30 in the morning, be down on their counters by when the bell rang and the doors opened. The shop remained open to people coming in until 9 o'clock at night. Then, at 9:15, a bell would ring and the doors would close, so people wouldn't be allowed in anymore. But they could continue to serve these people who were massing. This was a big Woolworths in Piccadilly, Manchester. Then the bell would ring at 9:30 and the tills would close. And so then you wait until everybody had gone out. Then the girls had to fill their counters again, ready for Monday morning. In the meantime, we who were the men's staff, the male staff, we had to clean the floors. Two of the floors, being wood, also had to be oiled. So you put a canister of oil on your back and you had a spray, and you, after sweeping it, you went behind. But this meant that it was around 10:30, 11, 12 before you got out, depending upon, you know, how much work you'd done. And one night, two girls who were, well, there was a big goods lift went up to the top floor. Two girls who were carrying a long tray of crockery were backing into the lift, and somebody had taken the lift away without closing the door, simply jamming a piece of wood, which was a normal practice. One of the girls was killed as she fell down the stairwell. By that time, I was well politicized, and so I went round to see. I mean, before the ambulance was called, the gate was repaired and everything was put right, and so on, and the whole thing was covered up, you see. And the story was that this girl had forced the gate open with thinking that the lift was there, you know, and it wasn't, you know.
Whose fault was it that she was killed?
It was the fact that this was the general practice, that the gate, the safety gate, was always left open because, you know, and it was fairly dark, you know, so there wasn't much light on and so on. It was a fact that there was no safety, it was that kind of thing. And I had already been agitating about the fact that these girls were working more than 5 hours at a stretch, because they would have a tea break at 5 o'clock, and there was no more tea breaks after that, and they were still there at 10, 11 o'clock at night, you see. And so I went round to see the parents, and somehow or other the manager always got to know that I had told the parents what really happened, so I was sacked on the spot. The strange thing was that I then decided that, you know, all of these white collar jobs, it was useless, I would have to get some money, so I then got myself a job as a painter and decorator.
Self-employed?
No, I went to a firm, and in those days, you went to the yard, and all unemployed men went to the yard with your overalls and everything else, and you wait outside, and the foreman would come out and you know. And I was, must have been 1934, because I was 20. Yes, this must have been 34, because I was not 21, and therefore I was getting paid 9 pence an hour instead of the 1 and 3 pence an hour sort of thing, you see. And it's very funny, but the first job I went to was at Woolworths, in this same Woolworths where I'd been sacked. We were night work, because we were painting the shop after it had closed. And the foreman gave me a pot of paint and told me to paint the lift gates, because these were the sliding lift gates, you know. And if anybody wants to use them, just step on one side and wait until the lift comes back down again. And of course, the first man to use the lift was the manager. And he spotted me, and he nearly went hairless, you know. Out, you know. Called the foreman, and the foreman told me, you know, sorry, but you've got to go, I can't keep you here. He said, anyway, you go to the yard tomorrow morning. He whispered to me, you know, go to the yard tomorrow morning. So I went to the yard the following morning, and he gave me a job back in another Woolworths.
Why was it that you joined the Communist Party rather than the Labour Party or some other left-wing organisation? Was it just because of chance meeting with the Kinder Scout people?
It was chance meeting with the Kinder Scout people, and also the impression that George Brown had on me when I went to this meeting, you know. And I hadn't met the Labour Party in the same kind of activity. I never met any Labour activists when I was hiking. You know, there was always where the Young Communist League were active and so on. Never met Labour activists on the activities against Mosley and so on.
Were there any other left-wing groups like Trotskyists?
No, I never knew anything about Trotskyists. Never met any Trotskyists.
Now, can we go on to Spain, and yes, can you tell me about the impact that the Spanish crisis made on you in 36?
Well, obviously, I mean, this the main activity of the Communist Party from July onwards was Spain, arms for Spain, collecting for Spain, food parcels for Spain, anything of that kind. This was almost a full-time, you know, it's a whole-time job. of the Communist Party of the Young Communist League from July 1936. And then in November 36, George Brown, this man who was the secretary of the Manchester Communist Party, he said to me, a lot of international volunteers are going to help the Spanish people. You know that the army has revolted against the Spanish people. So they are short of people to fight against this armed uprising. And that is being organised an international brigade.
Did he say this to you as an individual or to a group?
No, as an individual.
Under what circumstances was it? Did he call you in or what?
No, I often met him and, talked to him and so on. And there was a period in my life when I was a member of the Territorial Army. But that was only as a boy soldier. I was a drummer. My brother was a member of the Territorial Army and he persuaded me to join. And we were sort of sat at, I must have been 16, 17, not much more than that. And I became a drummer boy for a couple of years.
Lancashire Fusiliers?
The Manchester Regiment, the 8th Ardwicks. And so somehow or other, somebody must have told George Brown that I had been the Territorial Army soldier. I told him, that I'd only been a drummer boy, that I knew nothing whatsoever about it. So he said, well, that's all right, He said, if you want to volunteer, then we can arrange it. So I, thinking, that this was one way of doing what I believed in, I said, yes, I will go.
When was this?
This was in November 36. And I left and went to Spain. It was very, very simple. I simply, we had a party in George Brown's flat the night before. Then I caught a train to Manchester, went to London, arrived in London on the Saturday morning, went to a meeting either at the Earl's Court or somewhere like that on Saturday evening. On Sunday, left for Spain.
Just by yourself?
No, there was two of us. It was Judd Coleman from Manchester. Two of us went together. Obviously, there were other groups going.
Who was Jack Coleman?
He was just a friend, a member of the YCL in Cheetham. It was obvious that there were lots of people going because there was no, restrictions in those days. We simply got a... I can pinpoint the date, although I can't tell you which one it was, but that Sunday morning the paper was full of the burning of the Crystal Palace in South London. And that was the day I went to Spain. I think it must have been about the 23rd, 24th November, something like that.
Did you take any money?
We didn't have any money of our own. I put on a suit, the very first suit which I had bought myself from a tallyman. Not necessarily the best thing to go to war in. It was a double-breasted waistcoat and Oxford bags and that sort of thing, But just a few things, like a towel and toothbrush in a brown paper parcel. In London at King Street, they were given some money and tickets to go. We didn't need a passport because we were just going across the Channel for the weekend, And of course, when we got on the boat to go across, then the boat was full of Irish volunteers going. In fact, they were all in the bar downstairs, all singing Irish IRA songs and Irish songs and so on. It was quite a party going across.
Were they going to join the Republicans or the Nationalists?
No, to join the Republic. Yes, the International Brigade. This was Frank Ryan. That's the first time I met Frank Ryan. I met him a lot afterwards, and we were very close together, very close afterwards.
What kind of a chap was he?
Oh, he was great. You can just imagine a big, soft Irishman, and yet he could command attention without raising his voice. Yes, he was...
How do you mean soft?
You know, sometimes you meet these Irishmen who seem to be sort of cuddly. And that's the kind of man he was. It was very, very strange, you know, real command. And yet, you know, everybody loved him. That was the point. He got his command because everybody loved him. And he had this group of Irishmen. There must have been 20 or more of them, and they were all, you know, letting everybody know where they were going. They were going to fight Franco and so on. From the boat, we went to Paris. In Paris, we just left these Irishmen. Two of us went outside. We hailed a taxi and said we wanted place to combat. And off we went. And the taxi driver didn't even bother to ask us where we were going, you know, because he knew where we were going. It was obvious because when we got there, there was this building with queues of men outside. And we just went in, had us, it's just like being in the dentist's waiting room. You all move up one, and then you went in to have an interview, given your ticket, told to get back to the, I think it was Garçon Larazar that we went from.
So was this the French Communist Party who was organising?
This was the organisation that was doing it quite openly, because when we got to the station, it was almost like a troop train going out with all men kissing their wives goodbye and, you know, everybody. You didn't have to ask the ticket collector for a ticket, you know, you just went and gave him the money and he told you to go to that train there. It was completely open, just like that. We went to Perpignan. And arrived in Perpignan in the morning, wandered around during the day, beautiful sunny day, and then the word went round, I don't know how, but it went round and everybody was wandering around, all went to the station, got on a small train under the Pyrenees, and a quarter of an hour later you were in Spain.
So you had no problems getting to Spain?
No, none whatsoever.
What happened once you got there?
Well, once you get into Port Boo, there was a truck waiting, and that took us off to, can't think of the name of it's the famous one, everybody went to there.
Figueras.
This was a sort of dirty, castle, barrack sort of thing. Stinking to high heaven of men having slept there, and fortunately, we were only there 2 days.
Was it unpleasant?
It was very unpleasant because there was no facilities there of any kind. You know, you've got there were not even plates. Very often, you just got your food in your hand, or you found a tin can that somebody had thrown away and used that for a mug and so on. There was no organisation of any kind to receive us there. There was one incident when one of the Irishmen must have stepped out of line, and the little Italian officer wanted to arrest him.
Italian officer?
Not Italian, Spanish officer wanted to arrest him. And the Irishman threatened to throw him overboard, you know, if he tried it. But then along came Frank and he calmed them all down and calmed the officer down. because the officer had pulled out his pistol and fired a shot into the roof, you know, to get some attention. And of course, he was in danger of being completely mauled by these Irishmen. But Frank just calmed everything down, and then we all got into trucks and off we went to Barcelona. In Barcelona, there was a funeral of one of the, I'm not quite sure whether it was Durruti or one of, somebody was being, one of the leaders of the Spanish workers was being killed in Madrid, and was being, there was a funeral. And of course, we joined in this huge demonstration. We marched through Barcelona for about 2 hours. Now, eventually, taken to some barracks there, given a meal, lots of skylarking, lots of fun, you know, because we were introduced to the porron, which is the wine jar which the Spanish use, which they lift up in the air and let it pour down your chin, you know. And then we got on a train and travelled all night and finished up in Albacete.
What was there any demonstration in your favour from the populace?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anybody who didn't, the stewards, come on, cheer them on. These are internationals, you know, that sort of thing. You could see them as we marched, you know, everybody sort of cheering and shouting. And of course, we are still wearing the same clothes, you know, that we'd come from England in, and we've been 3 days then without taking them off.
Who were these stewards who were urging?
Well, these were militiamen. And by then, of course, there must have been 50 to 100 of us all together, of various nationalities, you see. Amongst the British speaking, amongst the English speaking, I would say the majority were these Irishmen. There was, in charge of our group, was a man from London named Ralph Campo, who was dual, his parents were French, and he was here. He'd be born, they lived in England, so he spoke French and English very fluently, you see. So he was in charge of our particular group. He later became a company commissar and was killed at Jarama, Ralph Campo. But he was in charge of us. We arrived in Albacete very early in the morning, much different from Barcelona, because we were now on La Mancha and there was swirling, freezing fog all the way around everywhere.
Was this before or after Christmas?
This was before Christmas. This was probably, I'm not sure whether it was probably the end of November or maybe the very beginning of December. Because we marched into what turned out to be the bullring at Albacete. And there we were harangued by André Marty in French. And of course, in a bullring, when you start shouting, it echoes all the way around the ring, you know, and this whirling mist and fog, and everybody freezing cold, been up all night, you know. We hadn't had very much to eat for, you know, the little bit that we'd had in Figueras, and the meal we'd had in Barcelona was just a sort of, you know, bread and wine and things.